Welcome to another episode of Surgeons Lives. I'm your host, John Monson. My guest today is one of a generation of true surgical academics working in the United States today. Justin Dimmick is the Frederick Collar Chair of Surgery in the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Justin undertook his undergraduate training in Cornell before going to medical school in Hopkins. He did his residency in the University of Michigan and took some time out to be a researcher in health services with one of his early mentors, John Birkmeyer, in Dartmouth. He returned on faculty to commence a career as a general surgeon with an interest in bariatrics, laparoscopy, minimally invasive upper GI surgery. And in 2020, became the chair of surgery. He has an extraordinary academic career that has resulted in millions of dollars worth of NIH funding, mainly centered in the field of surgical quality. His range of publications, almost 500 now, cover a vast array of the highest quality journals, including JAMA and the New England Journal of Medicine. His H factor is right up there. There's a few other things that you will not expect to hear from him as he talks about changing the culture of surgery in the conversation today. Since I spoke to him, of course, he's going to be even happier as Michigan became national champions in college football. But that hadn't happened when we spoke. So without further ado, let's go over and listen to the story of Justin Dimmick. I'm John Monson, and this is Surgeons Lives.
Hello, sorry. A few minutes late.
No worries.
You got me on a clinic day.
Clinic?
Yeah. I saw, I was like double booked for the entire day today.
Oh, well, it's better than being unemployed, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't mind it. I like the hectic pace.
And do you do just the one day clinic a week?
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm in the ORs on Mondays, clinic on Wednesday, and then kind of just PRN. I add a second RD if I have really cool cases to do. Like something the residents love. Like if I can find like a gastrectomy or a bariatric revision or a splenectomy or something the residents like, I know they'll love. I pick up a second day. Like yesterday.
Why not? You know? So anyway, Justin, thank you so much for taking some. I know you're very busy, and I appreciate it for chatting to me today on this what is for the most part a YouTube channel, but does appear as a podcast as well. It's young in maturity. There are six of the interviews live on YouTube at present, but a number more done. It's called Surgeons Lives, but with a strap line of saying stuff that matters, which of course may or may not be related to the workplace or outside of the workplace. Inevitably, by the nature of the business, some of the a decent chunk of the individuals are towards the autumn of their careers, but I've also got been careful to ensure that I'm also interviewing people who are what might be referred to as in the prime of their careers, although that term has become challenging recently. So it's kind of informal. But what I've asked people to do is, and I would ask you to do, if you wouldn't mind, is just start us off with a little life story, starting with the words I was born in. In your case, I think Vermont, yeah?
Yeah, I was born in, actually, I was not born in Vermont.
Oh.
Little known fact, I grew up in Vermont, but my father was a community banker in central Vermont, and he was in a management training program at the Bank of Boston when I happened to be born. So
Oh.
I'm one of my five siblings that was born in Boston, which you can imagine I get made fun of for not being a native Vermonter by all my extended family.
And you
So
lived for in Boston for all of days or years?
I think 2 days.
2 days, okay. It still counts, you
Yeah.
know.
So in Vermont, which is a very mountainous state, there's 36 peaks in the state of Vermont. We call people from Boston Flatlanders. And so that was what my family called me when they were angry with me.
And no doubt still do.
No doubt. So I grew up in Vermont, went to public high school in Randolph Union High School, which was a five town union high school because the towns are pretty small there. And I was a wrestler in high school and had the
Yes.
opportunity to be recruited to Cornell University, which Ivy League schools don't have a lot of great sports, but Cornell happens to be a great wrestling school. So I was recruited there and ultimately decided to major in pre-med instead of wrestling, and then went on to Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Was there medicine in the family?
Nope. Well, my grandfather had been a surgical tech in World
Okay.
War II, but he came back and thought he was too old to go into medicine, so he ended up he drove a truck, a grain truck. But he had a lot of good relationship with surgeons, and I remember him telling the story about the leader of their, MASH unit, their mobile unit that was going through France and Germany during World War II, was a great Johns Hopkins Medical School graduate.
Right.
And so I always had this kind of idea that it would be really neat to go there. And I ended up getting to go there. And I remember to this day, it was an emotional day for my grandfather because of that. He'd remember all these idols that were he worked for during World War II.
And your sibs, any other docs in the siblings or not? Just you?
Nope. Just me. I have a brother who's an artist, a brother who's a musician and woodworker. And so working with their hands, but no surgeons and no doctors.
So Hopkins, and I think you then you went to Michigan for a residency, yeah?
Yep, I left Hopkins after 5 years of medical school and did an extra year trying to figure out what to do with my life. And then went on to University of Michigan in 2000, when I've been there ever since in different roles.
Yeah. Was there a moment? I mean, did you always know you were going to be a surgeon, or were you a late bloomer in those thoughts, or was it a moment of a Damascene moment, as often appears in these personal statements, you know?
No, I was going to be a pediatrician because growing up in a small town, the only doctor I knew was a pediatrician. But I came late to surgery. I did surgery first because I knew I wasn't going to be a surgeon, and so I did it first. And still, I really enjoyed the craft of surgery, but I didn't enjoy the culture and sometimes the people. So I wasn't a big fan of surgeons and how they interacted with other people often. And so I didn't see myself as one. But over time, that's why I spent an extra year in medical school. I was just trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I basically did sub eyes. I did an extra year to do research, but I did sub eyes in emergency medicine, critical care, cardiology, just a lot of different things, and ultimately landed on surgery because of the craft. I just love the craft of surgery. And I chose my residency because it was a place that at that time, this is going back over 20 years, was a place where I think a lot of the there was a kind of positive culture. I got yelled at like zero times in my entire 7 years of training. It's a very non-malignant training program.
So, but you said a moment ago that you liked surgery, the craft of surgery. You didn't necessarily like the surgeons. Was that your that was your more of your Hopkins exposure as a medical student, or in your before residency? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that. I mean, it wasn't just Hopkins. I think
No,
in that,
we're not blaming Hopkins as exclusively.
no. I think that Hopkins was consistent with the culture more broadly at the time, and their, and this kind of quote surgical personality, which is widely captured and understood, I think, and or parodied maybe often. I think there was a cultural change a lot in the last 20 or 30 years, I think, for a positive way. I think so I think that was, I was looking for a place with a little bit of a different culture.
And how come you, I mean, once you went there, you stayed to in Michigan, but was there something that attracted you there in the first place, or was it just, partially the luck of the draw?
I was very attracted to the place. I think at the time, the people that I interacted with, actually, I'll tell you, I interviewed with three people. You probably know at least two of them. One of them was Mary Hahn, who had just finished training here and was a junior faculty member at the VA here while her husband was finishing his fellowship in ENT, and was super impressed by her and her personality. And Gib Upchurch interviewed me. You might know Gib. He's the chair of Florida. Obviously, Mary is the chair at Stanford. And Gib also was like a very positive, inspirational guy. And the third person I interviewed was Paul Taheri, who was an MD MBA, and he was our chief of trauma and burn here, but then went on to run the medical group at Vermont and then became the CEO at Yale Medicine. But he was a you know, also a really thoughtful, nice person who I thought was kind of doing some unique things in terms of getting an MD MBA. That was kind of unique at that time.
Unusual.
Thinking like very rigorously about management, healthcare management. So that was my exposure. And you go around, you get impressions, and I thought it was a good place to spend a few years.
So when you walked into Michigan, on your first day or your first week or your first month, was there a plan? Was there a master ambition? It's, I guess it's a two-part question. A, that question. And if I was to ask your graduating medical school class, would they say, would they have said, that guy Dimmick is, you watch that guy, he's going to do something. Or did they say, I don't know what's going to become of him, Were you one to watch at that stage?
Probably more the latter. I mean, by the standards of my graduating class at Johns Hopkins, I'm probably bringing up the rear, to be honest. There is it's an incredible group of people, and I'd say I more or less, was unremarkable in amidst that cohort. And probably was also a little weird. Like I used to knit in class, which was,
No, that is, that's definitely weird.
I didn't, I'm not a note taker. I'm like a, I'm a, like I listen, I like to listen deeply. And if my hands are engaged, I can listen much more deeply. So, but if you engage your hands in something like playing video games, it distracts your mind. So I found that knitting was the perfect thing to like do with my hands and leave my mind free to listen deeply. So, yeah, so they probably thought I was a little, that's not, it's probably more common nowadays than it was 20 years ago.
It is probably what they remember, though.
Probably. And I could knit in a couple lectures, I could knit an entire pair of mittens. So I'd take orders, who wants what and what color, and then I'd make them and pass them out at the end of class.
I was, part of the questions that I sometimes ask people is to tell me something that, people don't know about you. I think you've just ruined that by telling me this. So back to the other piece of the question. So, did you have an ambition? What was the vision? Was there a plan?
There was not a master plan. I basically had two goals in residency. One was to become a really good surgeon. As I mentioned, I was attracted from the craft and I wanted to get really good clinical training. And I didn't want to get yelled at a lot doing it, which is work, which panned out. I think Michigan is a very busy, at that time was a big, busy place where nobody yelled very much. And so that was kind of the best I could hope for. And so I had a great clinical training here. The other piece was I knew I had a strong interest in academics. Really, the creative and the discovery and the way that you can use scholarly endeavor to kind of improve the world in different ways, like that's really a powerful driver for me. And so I knew I wanted to do something. I knew I wanted it to be in the health services space, which was kind of a new space at the time. I had some exposure in medical school during my year off to some leaders in that area. And I just love the notion that you could make sense of the world through good data and then use that better understanding of the world, things that could be invisible unless you look at the data, and then use that data and that those analyses to shine the light on areas that needed an improvement, and improve. And so that became like those two pieces I think are still present in every role I've had, and I think are still present now, and how I lead in my current job.
So, this morning at our didactic session for the fellows, it was my task to give a talk I give on mentorship and sponsorship and everywhere in between, and one thing or another. Everyone needs a mentor. Did you have mentors early in your career, and how did you go about identifying your mentors?
I've had tremendous mentors over my career. I would say that I wish that I had learned to engage mentors earlier. I think I grew up in a way, there's sort of this New Vermont or New England stoicism where you just want to do it yourself and you're a little stubborn about that. And so I probably didn't engage with mentors much in medical school, as much as I should have, which is probably why I literally took a year off to figure out what I wanted to do with my career. And that was the first time I got exposed to what a mentor can mean for your career. And I'll tell the story because I was really did not know if I wanted to do surgery or medicine or anesthesiology and critical care or what exactly it was. And I ended up working with, there was one surgeon at the time who was doing rigorous epidemiology and clinical trials, and that was Pamela Lipsett, who's an intensivist and has subsequently been the president of the Society of Critical Care Medicine. And she is, at the time was doing some clinical trials, and I ended up applying for this clinical research training program at the NIH for a year. That was how I was what I was going to do my year off. And I think it was the first year of the program, there were 45 slots and 48 people applied, and I didn't get it. So I was like one of the few that didn't get it, and so I was like lost. And I had talking to them, like they're like, oh yeah, they're like, I don't even think as many people applied as we have spots, so you're going to be fine. And then I ended up being like one of the few that didn't choose. So I had nothing to do for the year. And I went into Dr. Lipsett's office. And like I said, this is one of the first mentors I had. And I remember she's like, I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I have no income. I'm like, I got nothing. I got nowhere to pay my rent. And she's like, don't worry, I got your back. Right. And then obviously took me under her wing. And like that, the power of a moment like that, when like you realize that somebody is going to use their power and privilege to like, about your career, it's a powerful thing. And I think because I've always taken mentorship seriously, because I remember what it feels like to have somebody have your back like that. So Pam was a great mentor, and to this day, whenever the ACS is in San Francisco, we have d dinner together at the Taj. It's just become like a tradition, the Taj Hotel. So we still keep in touch. And then she introduced me to her fellow at the time, who is a health services researcher named Peter Pronovost. Most people know Peter now. He did that checklist and published in the New England Journal of Medicine that Atul Gawande wrote about in his book on the topic. And Peter was a fellow, but became my primary research mentor during my year. And then he introduced me to John Birkmeyer, who they were both assistant professors consulting for the Leapfrog group around ICU staffing standards and volume outcome effects. And John Brookmeyer happened to live, work at Dartmouth near where I grew up in Vermont. So over Christmas break in 1997, I had coffee with him and kind of restarted our collaboration. And ultimately, he became my main research mentor
Yeah.
as a resident in health services research. And then obviously, clinically, I had other great mentors at Michigan. You know, Give Up Church being one of them. He became a really close friend and mentor. Mike Mulholland, of course, as our
Yeah.
chair. So a lot of opportunity to have great mentorship.
I had the opportunity a number of years ago when I was chairing the research committee of ASCRS to review a mentor's letter. I promised to mentor this applicant from John Berkmeyer, and I must have read it six times. And I remember copying it, copying it down and thinking to myself, this guy, the letter is better than most people's work, and I thought to myself, this is really the template for what a mentor should be. I suspect he probably had it as a template for, et cetera. But nonetheless, it was not the usual, yes, I promised to mentor Fred, and it'll all be good. It was just a very thoughtful, appropriate way, at a time when mentorship was not well described by people. As I've said to several people, people have said to me, this conversation we're having today, or conversations of this nature, didn't really happen 25 years ago. Talking about, how to navigate, was in surgery, as you mentioned, as you started at the beginning, was, considered a bit touchy feely, to be real. You should just be up all night every night, and take the hits and come back for more. As you say, that's the sort of culture. So you stayed in Michigan, and obviously, as they say, the rest is history, or at least the rest to this point. I was intrigued by the fact you're one of the few surgeons that has a Wikipedia page. Wikipedia must be true, mustn't it? Et cetera. But I was intrigued when I read your, there's the Michigan profile and, the standard stuff. But I was intrigued when I read your Wikipedia profile, that because it's not a very academic approach to a human being, it identifies things that the external observer says, sees without knowing the details. And it implies, it's, I'm sure you've read it, but and if you have, if you say you haven't read it, I'm sure you're lying, but it's really interesting, because if you were to ask, people about Berkmeyer Dimmick, they'll go for the rescue concept, et cetera. And it's fascinating that it, and the good quality and outcomes, et cetera. And it's fascinating that the Wikipedia basically says what really made this guy was this paper, which is kind of intriguing, that each and every one of us does have a moment where people see this was your turning point, this was your big moment, which may be totally and utterly untrue. But it's the, it's, and you think, my God, I'm an overnight sensation, having put 30 years of work into it. It's not an overnight sensation, but it's fascinating that that's the way it's observed by things like Wikipedia, whereas, you a dedicated career in health services research shouldn't really be distilled into one moment. You've mentioned that you're very interested in culture, or the, making sure that the residency and the program and the program you entered, continues to be nurturing and not threatening and not hostile, et cetera. For you, that's an intentional, that's something that you invest in rather than just let it happen passively.
Well, I think we all invest in our cultures, whether we mean to or not, right? Every interaction is culture building interaction, and that reinforces norms. So I think it's good to be intentional about it. I think it's good to be say who do we want to be, and what are our values, and what are we going to prioritize. But I think the intentionality is key, and so I think about a lot of how do you intentionally build culture, and like I will call an event a culture building event. Like last night we had a retirement ceremony, and putting that together, right? Like it is a celebration of someone's career. It is also a culture building moment, right? We're gonna talk about our values and how this person contributed to the values, and we're going to use every opportunity to reiterate who we are and who we want to be, where we come from, where we're going. And so, yeah, I think about it a lot. And to be clear, like I don't think we're perfect, right? Like we make mistakes, and everybody makes mistakes. And I think it's good to be humble about your mistakes and try and learn from them. That's kind of the key. No one can live in a mistake-free environment.
I was some years ago, Hopkins, started this program with MCIC or the self-insuring people in, that collaborative group with Rochester and Cornell and Hopkins and a couple of others, trying to identify the culturally misaligned recruits before they're recruited. And the theory being, of course, that most of the trouble comes from a small cohort of people. And it would be nice to be able to identify them before you made the mistake of recruiting them. And it's a, if you work in Florida, you realize that that's exactly what Disney do. They actually spend an entire day of their onboarding making sure that the person is a Disney person. And their famous phrase is, if they decide you're not a Disney person, they will help you find your happiness elsewhere. But it's they make the specific point that their entire business is based on that. You have to be a Disney person. Do you in Michigan now do anything particularly intentional when you're considering recruiting somebody to determine that they're culturally aligned, or are you more focused on the 5 million federal income, or where do you sit on all of that?
I mean, we do a lot, right? Because it is bringing in someone who, like, frankly, if your values aren't aligned with ours, you're not going to be happy here, right? Like, and so I think it's really important to be clear about what you believe in and what the values are of the organization. For example, I'm very upfront with people that like we have a salary model here, and everybody works hard in a different way. And the reason why we have rich academic programs and rich faculty and resident development programs is because we invest in them. And what that means is that if you want to work in a place like that, that is academic and has a lot of development opportunities, you don't take home every penny you make. And so what I tell people is if you want to drive a Maserati and live in a 10,000 square foot home, this probably is not a good place to work. If you work here, you have to live in a 6,000 square foot home and drive a BMW, right? And I think that that statement kind of puts a fine edge on the kind of hedonic treadmill of kind of earning and life. And like I see a lot of people with huge salaries complaining about burnout. And like I think, the hap you know the we can't not separate those things, right? And I think that we have some very busy clinicians here, and I want them to be people who want to be very busy clinicians, right? I need those people on my team, but I don't want people who don't want to be busy clinicians being busy clinicians to support their Maserati habit, right? And then complaining about burnout.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, what I normally say to people is, if you were valued exclusively by a dollar amount, then there's nowhere for you to go. Number one. Number two, you're permanently vulnerable to somebody tapping you on the shoulder saying, "Hey, how about if I offer you another $1,000?" And we know that people don't leave facilities academic facilities because of the salary. The salary is necessary to pay the bills, etc., to buy the BMW, etc. But, you know, being valued and being fulfilled is way more important on a sustained basis. I mean, if you want to just get on the RVU treadmill, it's exhausting after a while. I know, I totally agree with that. And it's been a very successful model, I think, in Michigan. That's the, you know, from what everyone can see. So when you switch the lights off at night, what happens? What does Justin Dimmick look like rocking and rolling at night?
So one of the nice things about Ann Arbor is it's pretty easy to get home and get around. And so I think a lot of us, you know, I think the statement about, I remember general surgery years ago, was unless you're in the OR clinic, like you can see tumbleweeds blowing through the offices of the general surgery section at 5 p.m. Right. I actually think that's a good thing. You know, people go to their kids' soccer games. They, you know, people may go to their kids' soccer games and then pull out and work on a paper or something at night or answer at the clinic nights. But like you can get home and, you know, so the first thing I do when I get out of here and, you know, as a chair, I have probably more evening commitments than the average person in terms of board meetings and dinners and ceremonies to MC and things like that. But I think when I can get out, you know, first thing I do is go see how I can spend time with my family. And that looks different in different ways. I have two kids who are 13 and 17. And so like tonight I get to go to a band concert at my son's school. And, you know, sometimes it's picking up from soccer practice, sometimes it's soccer games, sometimes it's tennis matches, but I try and make that like my biggest priority as soon as I can get out of here in the evening to see and be with my family. And in Ann Arbor, it's easier than in some places to do that. You can get across town pretty easily. Yeah.
It's a bit like Rochester was, you know, it's a 20 minute town. Everywhere is 20 minutes. It's very easy living.
And some places are 5 minutes. Like my son, there's some soccer fields right here next to the hospital that my son plays on some given days, which is, I can walk there. So that's, sometimes it's really convenient, but I say that's my biggest priority. When I get out of here.
So my first interview that I did, that I released, I should say, on the YouTube was Jeff Matthews, who, as you know, brings a couple of other things to the table. He, you know, culture-wise, I think he's a passionate believer in the similar cultures as you've described. And of course, he does have the when he puts the bandana on and turns into the rock god on a different day. He has that extra thing to him. You're not hiding from us, you know, some extraordinary skill or passion or hobby, like Jeff, although he doesn't hide it, of course. He's just released his latest salvo of songs, etc.
No, I mean, I am definitely much less interesting than Jeff Matthews. Like, just be very clear about that. I will say, and I'll tell a quick Jeff Matthews story. So he has always been kind of an inspiration to me, because he like broke the mold of what a surgical leader was. And so he's always been a role model to me. And I remember when he was president of the Society of University Surgeons, I was a resident at that meeting, maybe a second year resident or something like that. And to have a surgical leader of like, probably like a, you know, kind of prestigious honor society type organization, get up on stage and be handed an electric guitar from the band and then play, I think he played Johnny Be Good or something.
Yeah.
Like that is a culture creating moment. Right. Yeah. And to me, because as an impressionable resident, it gave everybody else permission to be their full selves or bring their full selves to the professional world. Right. He wasn't hiding this. He was like proud of it. And he's like, here I am, you know, I'm at the top of the profession. I also enjoy music and I'm just going to show you that right now. And he was having so much fun. And it was the first time I'd ever seen kind of a senior surgical leader. I mean, he probably wasn't that senior. He was probably still pretty young at the time, but he was the president of a society. And he, just openly said, look, I am more than my job. And so to me, that was a culture building moment to me and all my peers who got to see that.
In a very conservative environment and in a conservative profession. I'm kind of a contemporary of Jeff's, so I'm old enough to view, having been a chairman on the other side of the Atlantic for 15 years, I look at you as somebody who might receive the baton from a guy like Jeff Matthews. You're a new generation, and when I look at academic surgery around the country, and I'm not saying this just to blow smoke up your ass, you are clearly a new generation role model for academic surgeons in terms of the way you, I mean, you just are. I'm probably not very good at describing it. But if I was to ask you, so what would you want that to be called? What would you, if I said, tell the guy on the end of the phone, what does Justin Dimmick stand for? It's a tricky question, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I think well, first of all, that's incredibly kind of you to say, and I actually feel really lucky to, like I said, have great role models like Jeff and others, but also I feel like a lot of my peers shares, like I feel like I'm get to be part of a really supportive and kind of like-minded group of newer chairs around the country, and that and I think the one thing that I think my peer chairs, and I think Jeff has always done this well, that the things that I admire the most around the chairs around the country that are, I think, leading culture change, is rather than telling people how we should be and who we should be, we listen to the upcoming generation and let them tell us where we're going. So I think that I'd say that's what I stand for, is letting, rather than making the people entering our profession conform to some prop, much lesser ideal, which is kind of the history of a lot of organizations, is we let them come to work as themselves whole and give them the power and the privilege to shape the culture that they work in, and facilitate that as opposed to resisting it. So I think that is the key to success, like building places that are that where everyone feels like they can come to work and be safe and be whole, will result in better patient outcomes, will result in more successful careers. Like all of those things are true. There's less waste in a system that is inclusive. And so I think that's what I stand for, is letting people achieve their goals and have fun doing it, by being an instrument to listen and ch help change our profession.
It's interesting. I was up in Milwaukee yesterday doing an NAPRC site visit, and so I had some plain time to waste. And I stumbled across a four-part Netflix series just released by Barack Obama, basically on what work means to people. They're short little episodes. And, does work just mean going to pay the bills, or does work mean something more? And how it means different things to different people, going from the hourly worker all the way up to the CEO. And it's not a political issue, a political program. But it's interesting talking to the people what work means to people, and you can see, regardless of where people are, the ability to come to work and feel something other than just I have to be here to make the money, is kind of an important thing. I agree with you. I mean, I think it's very important. So with that in mind, are you optimistic for the future for young surgeons?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just seeing the kind of floodgates open to change in surgery. And when the current generation of people in, junior faculty and residencies are running American surgery, it's going to be a completely different space. And I think you kind of already can see it and feel it. If you go to organizations like the Association for Academic Surgery that kind of have built platforms for kind of this incoming generation, like it's a totally different field. And even, the American Surgical, which, is probably the, I think it says in their tagline, the oldest and most prestigious surgical organization. Diana Farmer was the president this year, and she and I ran a session for a presidential session on the collision of corporate medicine and changing workforce expectations. And the people, the room was full, people were engaged. And I think there's just been so much change in the last, I mean, every year it feels like there's more and more change in all of our spaces in academic surgery. So I'm very optimistic. And I think, all you have to do to be optimistic is give power to the next generation, and they will make
Well,
sure we're headed in the right direction.
that's a real segue into a question I sometimes ask people. So you're here you are now, chair. How long have you been chair for now?
4 years.
4 years. Your predecessor was chair for 15, 16, 17, something like that, years, moved on to greater things, etc. Do you think you will be chair when you're 75, or will you move on? I it's my I personally am a believer in not giving someone else a chance, as you say. I was a chairman for 15 years, and I think I was pretty good at it for 12 of them. Not necessarily the last three, but you're not always on your game, etc. But one way or another, I am a believer in letting somebody else have a chance, etc. Not holding with a death-like grip, etc. What's your thinking about that? Are you going to stay there forever and ever and ever until you're 75?
Well, I wouldn't be allowed to. I think that those days are probably over. Our institution in particular has 2 5-year terms as a term limit. You can get like minor extensions beyond that for, a couple of years, mostly, to serve the purposes of kind of like pacing, changing chairs, while I change. So I think as our policy is written now, you have 2 5-year terms and then 2 2-year terms, which are really just extensions to run a search, or so we don't have three chairs turning over. So that's my future. I'm 4 years into my first term. If I get renewed, I mean, I fully plan on serving for 2 terms, because I think we're doing great work here. I'm super proud of the work that my faculty and teams are doing here, and I think we can help kind of usher in, a brighter future for American surgery.
Do you think it's better to, are you a fan of the serving for 25, 30 years, or
No,
should you?
I mean, I'm with you. I'm with you on this. I will not. I by policy will not be the chair here at 75. I mean, plus that's we had a chair here. The chair of dermatology here was the chair for something. He'd been appointed, I think, 1975, and recently turned over, which is like that's got to be some kind of record. But no, I think everybody agrees. Like, I think probably 10 or 12 years, 3 or 4 years is too short. Like, you can't do everything you promise you're going to do in your vision talk in 3 or 4 years. Much less two. But I think in 10 years, 10, 12 years, not only have you had enough time to have the impact, you've probably made most of the impact that you're going to by that point. And I think about it, I was a division chief before this of minimally invasive surgery and bariatrics. And I was the chief, gosh, for 8 years. And during those 8 years, I had reworked the process and flow for our bariatric surgery program as it grew and facilities changed. And like the third time, I was like, I can't do that again, right? Like somebody else needs to do this, right? So I think you can only like go through those cycles so many times before you're just like, I did that 3 times. I know I can do it again. I don't want to do it again. Let somebody else do this. So I think that most of the impact you make will probably come out in 10 to 12 years. That being said, I think Mike Mulholland, he was chair for 17 years, and I think he did more in his last five. Like, I think he was really rigorous about reinventing himself and repurposing his mission. And he's a very disciplined person about what are we doing this year? What are we doing this 5 years, right? So I think that there are exceptions.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. And of course that's the downside to, in the other side of the Atlantic, the 65 is mandatory regardless of who you are, etc. And that's Probably overall good for 80% of the time, and there's 20% you're having to get rid of somebody who's a genius, but most of us are not geniuses, you know, and they will not remember does you know how they spell your name 6 months after you're gone, you know. I mean, that's kind of normal. So one very brief last question, and then a couple of quickies. Is there a bucket list for you in life? You want to climb Kilimanjaro or?
I don't really have anything like that. Probably at one point, being a chair surgery, like seeing if I could do that was on my bucket list. But I don't have anything beyond that professionally. Personally, I you know, most of my kind of life landmarks I'm looking forward to are around my kids and seeing them progress through different stages of life and getting to enjoy that with them. No, I mean, I'm very like. Just, I think I lack ambition in any of those regards. Somebody can, we have one of our orthopedic surgeons like is trying to climb all like those major peaks and he's got most of them done.
Yeah,
That sounds
that's like
dangerous
hard
to me.
work, you
Yeah,
know.
sounds dangerous.
That is very it, no, that's not true actually. It doesn't sound dangerous. I think it is
Actually is. It
dangerous.
actually is. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so here are the six questions that you have 10 seconds to answer. There are no right or wrong answers other than the fact that obviously I know the right answer. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, baseball or football?
Football.
Cats or dogs?
Neither.
Coke or Pepsi?
Coke.
Mac or PC?
Depends if I'm work at home. Mac at home, PC at work.
Beatles or Stones?
Neither.
Burger King or McDonald's?
Neither.
Home or away?
Home.
Okay. Thanks very much, Justin. I really enjoyed it. I really appreciate it. I know it's a little different to the normal hours you spend at work, but I appreciate it. And it's I'm just trying to let people see that you know, the podium presentation isn't necessarily all the thinking that goes on in surgeons' minds, and everybody's a little different, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
All right, great. Thank you for having me.